The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And continuing this episode, we'll dig deeper into the November issue of Our State Magazine, featuring articles all about North Carolina's Heroes Among Us, a salute to the military personnel who call our state home. This article turns to Goldsboro. It's entitled Growing Up Goldsboro. Being raised in the shadow of Seymour Johnson Air Force Base provided one writer an emotional lens through which to view the world. Awake in the small wooden bed my father built. The house is rattling. A pair of F-4 Phantoms as loud as thunderclaps are directly overhead. The sound is as familiar as the muted orange flowers on my wallpaper. I can see them in my mind's eye way up in the clouds. Sleek, paper airplane-shaped silhouettes against the morning sky. It's the mid-1980s, the waning years of the Cold War. Although at age four, I know nothing of such things. What I do know is that our house lies directly in the flight path of Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, home to four F-4 squadrons and a KC-135 squadron. The house stills. The roar ebbs to a growl. I sigh happily. My world is exactly as it should be. It's my first day of school at Meadow Lane Elementary. A labyrinth of covered walkways and sidewalks, and stark, low-slung buildings. In 1957, the year my mother was born, the federal government allotted funds to build this school next to the new base housing. Miraculously, I find my way to Mrs. Tyndall's class and take a seat amid a cluster of desks next to a girl named Holly Martin. She walks to school from the base, through a big gate that opens and closes each morning and afternoon. Soon, I will claim Holly Martin as my first best friend. On the playground, we shout over the screens of jets. Inside, Mrs. Tyndall, like all the other teachers, pauses her lessons until the noise passes. On the last day of school, Holly heads towards the gate, and I fall into a single-file line for the buses. I will never see her again. I'm beginning to understand that a military base gives best friends, but it also takes them away. Second grade is half over, but the girl with chin-length hair and thick bangs has an unscuffed book bag filled with shiny new folders and crayons. The teacher introduces her to the class, seats her at the desk next to mine, and instructs me to look after her. Her name is Krista, and she has come from an Air Force base in West Germany, a place that seems to seven-year-old me as far away as the moon. Soon, Krista and I are having sleepovers at each other's houses. She admires our big backyard and how our home isn't attached to anyone else's. I envy her townhouse and second-floor bedroom. For the first time in nearly 2 years, I have a best friend. But third grade brings more changes. My parents divorce, a new school where my classmates are more likely to be the children of farmers than airmen. Krista and I lose touch. Later, when Iraq invades Kuwait just before the start of my fourth grade year, the whole town holds its breath. Airmen of the 4th Tactical Fighter Wing are among the first units to be called to the Middle East. The base is transitioning from the F-4s of my early childhood to the F-15 Strike Eagles, and these will play a key role in the outset of the Gulf War. When news of the first casualties from that 42-day conflict begins rolling in, I watch a boy older than me, a year older than me, weep in the hallway. A teacher moves to comfort him. In ninth grade, I'm sitting on the bleachers that overlook the football field and notice the sound of a voice I haven't heard in 7 years. It's Krista, who turns out never left Goldsboro. We are teenagers filled with certainty about the future. Once a week, members of the Air Force Junior ROTC wear sharp blue uniforms and gather around the flagpole in front of our high school. My friend Sarah, the daughter of an Air Force officer, is one of them. On Friday nights, we kill time by driving on and off base so much that I'm afraid we're arousing suspicion. The security officer, though, just waves us through with a salute. Eventually, we'll graduate together, and a few years later, Krista's active-duty father will walk her down the aisle where she'll marry an active-duty groom. I'll be a bridesmaid in their wedding. What locals call the sound of freedom is now a soundtrack so familiar that I sometimes forget to listen. Peace is fragile, and it shatters on that clear September morning in 2001 when F-15s fly, glinting silver in a cornflower blue sky. For a generation, this day will change what it feels like to hear the roar of a plane overhead. It will change this town. It will change this nation. I'm on the other side of North Carolina, away at college, when the terror attacks of 9/11 unfold. But a high school friend who will later become my husband is headed to class at Wayne Community College, where airmen often study. A second plane has hit the World Trade Center when he arrives too late to class. The South Tower has already fallen. One of his classmates wordlessly shoves his things into his backpack and shoots out the door. He will not return. From where I am, I can't see them, but I know they are coming. Two, possibly three F-15s flying in formation. 20 years have passed since then, and that war is behind us. But peace, I know now, can vanish as quickly as the contrails that streak the sky over Goldsboro. Though I've not called this city home for more than two decades, my family is still here. Their homes just a few miles from base. The air vibrates and the din of jet engines fills my ears. The F-15s will appear any second, pointed noses emerging from the clouds like bullets. I stand with my children, ages 7 and 8, in my grandfather's yard. For the first time, I understand the uniqueness of growing up in a place where the sky is full of thunder, even on the clearest day. The planes are directly overhead now, but I know they will be gone in an instant. Look, I say to my kids, look. My world is exactly as it should be. And there's a little mini article that goes with this. It's on base. It's Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. In August 1940, as fighting intensified across Europe, the War Department deemed the municipal airport near Goldsboro crucial to national defense. Months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, construction began on an Army Air Corps technical training school, and locals began a campaign to name it after one of their own. Navy Lieutenant Seymour A. Johnson was a Goldsboro native and a graduate of Goldsboro High School who'd volunteered for duty as a test pilot in 1937. Johnson was killed on March 5, 1941, when his crewman F-4F-3 crashed near Norbeck, Maryland. The campaign was successful. Seymour Johnson Field became official in 1942 and remained active throughout the war, serving as a separation center for returning troops until its deactivation in May of 1946. A decade later, as tensions grew between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, it was reactivated as Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, a tactical air command facility. Today, Seymour Johnson comprises 6,425 active and reserve military personnel and employs another 600 civilians, and it remains the only Air Force base named in honor of a Navy officer. Here's a little mini article, another one about Wayne County. Wayne County Museum. In 1942, as the U.S. sent its young men to war in Europe and the Pacific, the Goldsboro Women's Club offered up its headquarters to the USO. As many as 12,000 service members passed through the doors of the Jeffersonian Revival-style building on North William Street every month for dances, parties, movies, and more. It functioned as a USO until it was officially turned back over to the Women's Club in January of 1947. Today, the building is home to the Wayne County Museum, but echoes of its past remain. The original neon USO sign hangs above a military uniform on the second floor ballroom, now the museum's military gallery, which showcases local history during conflicts dating back to the Civil War. This year's fall-winter exhibit will be the history of Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. The building has its own history. At the end of World War I, local women began operating a cafeteria and running a filling station to raise funds to build a women's club headquarters. It was completed in 1927 at a cost of $46,000. The women's club paid off the mortgage at the end of World War II with funds donated by the USO. The Wayne County Veterans Memorial Park. Born out of Wayne County's desire to honor residents killed during World War I, the Wayne County Memorial Community Building was officially dedicated in the summer of 1925. For nearly eight decades, it served the community in many ways, including providing office and meeting space for the American Red Cross, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, the Boys and Girls Club, the American Legion, and more. The building was destroyed by fire in 2004, but the bronze plaques bearing the names of those who lost their lives at war survived. Out of the ashes rose the Wayne County Veterans Memorial Park, advocated for by veterans and others who wanted the space to stay true to its origins as a living memorial to Wayne County's war heroes. Today, the park consists of a pavilion, brick walkways, a sculpture, flags, a fountain, and 50 varieties of plants and trees. A memorial wall bears the original bronze plaques recovered from the fire. The cornerstone of the original community building, dated 1924, also remains. Our next article is entitled, Doing the Most on the Coast. An Elizabeth City-raised writer reflects on the relationship that the local Coast Guard base has long shared with its community. And on this, we have a couple of photos. We have a Coast Guard base, Elizabeth City's Joshua Godot, Matthew Rhodes, Kristen Patterson, Michael Lucas, Catherine Carabine, Robin Stith, Alex Balin, Mayoung Kim. Know that the call to action can come at a moment's notice, so they're always at the ready. And on the facing page, it's a Coast Guard helicopter out over the water. I crane my neck, watching two other kids race each other up the broad ropes dangling from the cavernous ceiling that shelters the pool. They climb higher, then even higher. That's high enough, Coach cautions. One releases his grip and drops down into the pool with a magnificent splash. He surfaces, laughing. Be careful, Coach warns. We would do this for P.E. back in Alaska, the boy chides. I'm 12, at a summer clinic with the rest of Elizabeth City's swim club team. We practice at the Coast Guard base's indoor pool, where we spend hours running drills, punctuated by a snack break on the sidewalk overlooking the hangars in Pasquotank River. I want to wear the elite rescue fins propped up against the wall. They seem to be half my height, and Coach says absolutely not. For me, this venue is slightly familiar. Years earlier, my first swim team practices were held here until the YMCA opened. For the Coastie kids, this place is very familiar. The base is where their parents work, and the pool was designed to resemble the facilities at other Coast Guard bases across the country. To them, the ropes are a universal amenity. I love having Coast Guard kids on the swim team. Their splits are unmatched, and they possess endurance beyond their years. As a young person, it's my favorite advantage of growing up in a Coast Guard town, no matter how self-serving. Elizabeth City's more than 800-acre Coast Guard base is home to six units, including the Aviation Logistics Center and the Aviation Technical Training Center. My first appreciation for the scale of its facilities came in 2005 when it was used as filming location for The Guardian, and the whole town buzzed with Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher sightings. But why here, I recalled asking my dad. We have one of the biggest Coast Guard bases on the continental U.S. Why not? It's not the biggest base, but it is one of the busiest, and the area it serves is particularly vast, spanning as far as the Azores and the Caribbean. and even providing support for the International Ice Patrol, which tracks icebergs in the northern Atlantic and sub-Arctic oceans. The Coast Guard helps people in their most challenging moments, says Catherine Carabine, commanding officer of Air Station Elizabeth City. On a daily basis, even at Thanksgiving and Christmas, you have a crew who's here and ready to launch at a moment's notice. As we're on the phone, the roaring sound of a C-130J comes through the receiver. Hear that? Carabine asks, interrupting herself. I love that I get to be here every day and listen to that. I envision the plane's crew, cool and composed, returning from an ocean rescue. Growing up in Elizabeth City, I was so accustomed to the routine whoop, whoop, whoop of choppers and the roar of Lockheed HC-130 planes that I didn't even look up when these aircraft flew overhead. To me, the Coast Guard was omnipresent throughout town. USCG families lived on our street, went to our church, had kids on their swim team. We waited in line at the coffee shop next to petty officers and lieutenants in uniform. This integration is unique to Elizabeth City, says retired Captain William Chip Lewin. You see, this is a lot more here than you do at bigger cities, where there are different community pockets. The only other place he's seen quite like this is Sitka, Alaska. In fact, with the base providing more than 3,000 jobs to the community, between active duty service members, civilian employees, and contractors, the community and base are almost fully integrated. When Carabine moved to Elizabeth City in the summer of 2023 to assume Captain Lewin's position as the commanding officer of the air station, it was a homecoming of sorts for her husband, who'd been stationed at the base when they first started dating. When we came back here from Washington, D.C., you could just see the sense of calmness that surrounded my husband, she says. We love how warm and welcoming the community is and seeing how this area supports Coast Guard families. At the end of the day, if my family is supported, I love the area. The pool I remember from childhood is no longer in use at the Coast Guard base, but the base is now home to the annual Coast Guard Marathon. This is fine with me, as I, too, traded in swimming for running over the years. In 2024, the full and half marathons and 5K, which are open to the public, brought in some 2,700 runners from around the globe to participate. This made it one of the military's largest public-facing events. The runners traversed downtown and rural Elizabeth City, including a once-in-a-lifetime dash around the airfield at the base. I happened to be in town visiting my parents the weekend of the race. I'm no marathoner, and I timed my daily run so that it in no way crossed paths with the athletes. Well, as in most small towns, whatever you plan to do, you'd better expect some company. My faulty calculations put me across the finish line behind the first and second place runners. People cheered, and although I waved my hand saying, no, 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 I'm not a runner, cowbells, applause, and whistles still ushered me bashfully across. I didn't deserve the support, not the way the hundreds of runners around me did, but that's just how the Coast Guard community is here. You don't have to be the fastest swimmer. You don't have to be a marathoner to feel like you're part of the team. And we'll throw in a couple of extra little mini articles associated with this. There's an on-base article for Coast Guard Base, Elizabeth City. Eastern North Carolina has long had Coast Guard ties, starting with the Cedar Shake U.S. life-saving service stations that once dotted the coastline. Coast Guard Base Elizabeth City is one of the oldest air stations within the branch, commissioned in 1940 on land that was once part of the Hollowell family's Bayside Plantation just southeast of town. The timing positioned the base to play a critical role as the U.S. declared its involvement in World War II. Army, Navy, and Coast Guard personnel trained there, and members led search and rescue missions for survivors of torpedoed ships. Eventually, the base acquired seaplanes to advance search and rescue capabilities, leading to its renown as an air station. Home to the Aviation Logistics Center, Aviation Technical Training Center, Air Station Elizabeth City, Small Boat Station Elizabeth City, Aviation Projects Acquisition Center, and National Strike Force Foundation Center, Coordination Center, Base Elizabeth City is the cradle of aviation for the Coast Guard. The specialized centers support the entire military branch. Each aircraft in the USCG comes here for complete overhaul every 4 years. plus all enlisted active duty mechanics, electricians, and rescue swimmers train at the Aviation Technical Training Center for A-class school and then return for C-school, meaning as Aviation Logistics Center Executive Director Ed Gibbons puts it, they come here to train for the rest of their careers. And another little article here, this is In Action, Museum of the Albemarle. Elizabeth City's cultural Grand Dam overlooks the waterfront park and the Pasquotank River. The museum shares and interprets the history of the counties around the Albemarle Sound, from Northampton to Hyde. Unsurprisingly, part of the museum's focus is the region's maritime culture, which is evident as you step into the entrance and see a restored 1904 shad boat suspended from the soaring ceiling. At this free museum, you can explore two floors of exhibits on topics that range from surfing in northeastern North Carolina to boat building traditions and decoy carving. And then there's another little tiny article. It's called In Business, and it's the Roots Plant Company. Massive Monstera leaves tower overhead. Potted philodendron, ZZ plants, and succulents overflow from tables and stands, and baskets of pothos and ferns hang from the ceiling inside this lush, earthy oasis. Owner Molly Hoffman served for 7 years in the Navy, where she met her husband, Christopher. He now serves in the Coast Guard, which brought their family to Elizabeth City. Hoffman's boutique plant shop is a destination drawing out-of-town clientele who make a day trip out of finding new additions for their plant collections before concluding with a beer around the corner in Palin's Alley. For more info on Roots Plant Company, check out rootsplantco.com. And our next article is entitled Rising to the Occasion. Named the defense capital of the state, Wilmington earned the distinction of World War II Heritage City, thanks in part to the work of a veteran who was inspired by the port city's conflict response. Just before 8 a.m. on December 7, 1941, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. At home in my native Wilmington at age 7, I learn about the attack while listening to a Washington Redskins game. In the war years to come, it seems like a man from every other house in my Forest Hills neighborhood serves in uniform. 5 die. All told, 250 men from New Hanover County or with a connection to the area will lose their lives in combat, accidents, or from illnesses related to all theaters and fronts, including the battles of Normandy and the Bulge, and in Sicily, Saipan, Iwo Jima, Cassino, Okinawa, and Germany, as well as in the air and at sea. New Hanover High School produces 2 Medal of Honor recipients, Lieutenant Charles Murray Jr. for his service in Alsace, France, and posthumously Navy Corpsman Billy Halliburton, who was killed in action on Okinawa. Wilmington also is the hometown of Tuskegee Airman Percy Heath, 3 generals and an admiral. On the home front, we kids fight alongside them in make-believe battles from Guadalcanal to North Africa. A speedy bike ride propels me to the Central Pacific or Normandy. Backyards and vacant lots transform into trenches and dugouts. In many ways, Wilmington becomes a military city. All 5 armed forces are stationed here or nearby, but it's still very much an army town, with a population swelling to around 100,000. The North Carolina Shipbuilding Company, based here, becomes the state's largest employer, building 243 vessels, including Liberty cargo ships for the Navy and Merchant Marine. In town, 3 camps house German Afrika Korps prisoners captured in North Africa. I interact with the POWs, exchanging writing material for canteen items. Off our coast, many believe that German U-boat fires on Ethel Dow chemical plant in Curry Beach in 1943, which would make it the only attack against America's East Coast. For me, military service begins when the Navy commissions me as an ensign at 21. In 1956, I board my first ship in Japan. In 1964, following assignments on 6 ships and earning an amphibious warfare specialty, I leave the Navy. At 30, I enter politics, a road that leads me from being chief of staff to 2 Carolina California congressman to serve Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. When I retire to Wilmington in 1997, I see that neglect and indifference threaten the future of the city's World War II history. I first set my sights on helping save the 2nd and Orange Streets USO Club, one of the few original USOs left in the country. My father had served on the County Defense Committee that sponsored its construction in 1941. Here, my shipyard worker sister met her Army officer, future husband of 60 years. In 2000, I established an all-volunteer nonprofit World War II Wilmington Homefront Heritage Coalition to help identify, preserve, and interpret our legacy of service. The organization helps renovate the wartime USO, now the Hannah Block Historic USO and Community Arts Center, in 2008, and maintains the site's Homefront Museum, which features a memorial for each of the New Hanover County service members who died during the war. My work to preserve war-era attractions continues in 2013 when Governor Pat McCrory appoints me to the USS North Carolina Battleship Commission. We help raise $17 million for major hull repairs to the battleship memorial, which has been moored here since 1961. The highlight of my preservation efforts, however, begins in 2007 when I discover that no community has yet staked a claim on the title World War II Heritage City. Why not us? For nearly 13 years, securing that designation for Wilmington consumes me. Finally, on September 2, 2020, in a ceremony at the Battleship North Carolina with President Trump, the city is officially declared the nation's first American World War II Heritage City. That day is my life's proudest moment. All right, to wrap things up, I'm going to try and cover the Tar Heel timeline, which is entitled Old North Spotlight, from an Academy Award-winning movie to one of the most beloved romantic scenes on the big screen. Many filmmakers have looked to North Carolina's beauty and homegrown talent to bring their stories to life. 1910s, North Carolina mountains become popular location for production companies, some settling in Asheville and Hendersonville. Trend continues until the late 1920s when the advent of talkies makes open landscapes less ideal for filming. In the 1920s, W.S. Scales, one of the few black film producers of his era, opens North State Film Corporation in Winston-Salem. In 1922, Ava Gardner is born in rural Grabtown near Smithfield. The actress stars in movies like Magambo and The Night of the Iguana during her 45-year career. 1987, Dirty Dancing premieres, and it's a hit. Several scenes are shot in a former sleepaway camp at Lake Lure, most notably Baby and Johnny's iconic dance routine. 1980, Governor James B. Hunt creates the North Carolina Film Office. Over the next 20 years, the state's economy gets an estimated $5 billion boost from the film industry, and Wilmington is nicknamed Hollywood of the East. 1960, Mount Airy native Andy Griffith stars as the sheriff in The Andy Griffith Show. Following the show's success, Griffith headlines in the acclaimed series Matlock and television films. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and you'll be back to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of our magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and can be reached at 919-781-1973. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, call us at 919-832-9138, 5138. So long till next time.